parachute, $6,000 parachute. We made it to the Paris news. Don't talk about style, cause I embarrass you. Shut the fuck up when you talk to me, for I embarrass you. Can a young nigga get money anymore? Tell Peter my mink is dragging on the floor. Can I have a bad bitch without no flaws? Come to meet me without no draws. And the whole industry wanna fuck your old chick. Only nigga I got respect for is Wiz. And I'll admit I fell in love with Kim. Around the same time she had fell in love with him. Well, that's cool, baby girl, do your thing. Lucky I ain't had Jake drop him from the team. La Familia,
Rock Nation. There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called?
The news brought to you live.
News program. This is the Wednesday edition of Off the Hour. We are 30 days into the month of May, and tonight I am your host Kevin with Gary and with Steph at Tech, and Gary and Dave is in the house. On tonight's show, we'll hear a presentation called Autonomous Media: A Decade After Indie Media. The roundtable discussion was organized by CKUT Radio and the Montreal Media Co-op and was held at the Montreal Anarchist Book Fair on May 19th. As well as we do every Wednesday, we will bring you community announcements and Matt's Mix. A notice to Montreal Police and Jean Charest: here at CKUT, we are a group of over 50 volunteers, and we have not given our plans to the police, and we will not be asking for permission to broadcast this show. Stay tuned. You're listening to a special edition of CKUT's community news program, Off the Hour, hosted and engineered by the Avalanche, an initiative of the West Montreal Readaptation Center. All abilities are welcome. If you'd like to get involved, call 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or email news@ckut.ca. Do stay tuned. It is 5:01. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Off the Hour here at CKUT 90.3 FM. We will spend the next hour tonight hearing from a special roundtable discussion held in Autonomous Media Room at this year's Anarchist Book Fair. The presentation was called Autonomous Media: A Decade After Indie Media. We will hear from Pat Cadoret from CMAQ and Gretchen King from CKUT, Laura Neal from CUTV, independent filmmaker Amy Miller, and Tim McSorley from the Media Corp. Here is the presentation. Autonomous Media.
Purpose of this discussion is to talk about the massive transformation of technology, and especially in the domain of media, and in what way those new medias, new technologies are used by radical groups or people who produce media, and what is the changing role of independent media in the current state of things with new technologies, new media, and what's coming up for the future in that regard.
Pat Cadoret is a translator, self-employed worker, and an anti-capitalist militant based in Montreal. He has been active for over 10 years in various grassroots collectives opposed to war, police violence, and neoliberal globalization. He has been a member of the administrative committee of the Centre des Médias Alternatifs du Québec since 2001.
Second, we have Gretchen King, currently a second-year doctoral student in the Communication Studies Department at McGill University. She has also worked extensively as a community media practitioner. She helped to co-found the Independent Media Center online, indiemedia.org. Gretchen has also organized with Radio Tactic, a micro-FM and web radio station, which amplified popular mobilizations in Montreal. She recently published a chapter on these experiences in a book called Islands of Resistance, Pirate Radio in Canada. Gretchen helped to launch Groundwire, a nationally syndicated community news program currently airing on more than 30 campus and community radio stations across Canada. She was the executive producer in CKUT's award-winning news department for nearly a decade.
Laura is a militant and a journalist. She has been involved for 10 years in various projects linking media and community. She has lived in Ecuadorian Amazon and participated in the development of innovative college-based on the needs and realities of local communities. For the last 2 years, she has been worked on the development of community television CUTV at Concordia.
Tim McSorley is an editor for the Media Co-op and the Dominion magazine. He's a member of the Montreal Media Co-op editorial collective. He has also collaborated with other community media organizations in the city, including CKUT Radio and CUTV.
On leur a donc posé trois questions, mais comme je le disais, c'est vraiment des amorces.
So access to information and communication technologies, as well as to diverse sources of information and perspectives, has increased considerably over the last decade. How does this modify the rapport with media and the power dynamic with institutions of capitalism?
Many corporate lobbies and state institutions are trying to restrict access and sharing information and commercialize it. Discuss issues surrounding ownership of information.
Should ICTs, social networks, cellular phones, increasing numeric memory and its consequences for photography and video, as examples, be considered tools or dangers for the anti-authoritarian movement? How do independent and radical media fit into this paradigm?
Alors, sur ça, on invite à vraiment beaucoup parler. On invite Patrick Cadorette à nous formuler ses réflexions sur le sujet.
Ben, je ne sais pas à quelle mesure je vais répondre, même toucher à ces questions-là. Je pense que ça va revenir. Je pense que toutes ces questions-là vont revenir à la surface dans les questions, les discussions. Moi, je pensais surtout de faire un retour sur l'histoire du Centre des médias alternatifs du Québec, parce que, justement, de la façon que les questions sont formulées, je pense que surtout la première, je pense, la première et la deuxième, le réseau Indymedia sur lequel c'est basé, dans le fond, le CEMAC, il y a des différences sur lesquelles on va revenir, et des différents sur lesquels on va revenir initialement à la création, à la fondation du Centre des médias alternatifs du Québec, qui était initialement dans le réseau international Indymedia, mais qui fonctionnait un petit peu différemment initialement, puis aussi il y a des nuances politiques aussi à soulever quant à ça. Mais je pense que autant le CEMAC que le réseau Indymedia a été conçu en tant que réseau et en tant que plateforme de diffusion d'informations, comme réponse à certains problèmes qui sont soulevés, notamment la marchandisation de l'information, la concentration, le filtrage de l'information pour dans les médias grand public qui, dans le fond, reflètent les intérêts du modèle capitaliste puis des grands acteurs du système capitaliste. Alors, je pense que Gretchen va revenir sur la création du réseau Indymedia. Chronologiquement, ça va peut-être être plus intéressant de commencer avec ça. Mais moi, je vais commencer avec la création, en fait, du réseau, puis l'histoire un petit peu, du site du Centre des médias alternatifs du Québec. Qui était intimement lié, en fait, avec le Sommet des Amériques qui a eu lieu à Québec en avril 2001. Et je pense, si je ne m'abuse, c'est au cours de l'année 2000, en fait, qu'a été lancée l'idée de constituer un centre de médias alternatifs pour fournir une information alternative, justement, une information autonome sur le Sommet des Amériques. Or, et c'est justement ce qui est un peu différent du réseau Indymedia, c'est que la naissance du Centre des médias alternatifs du Québec n'est pas venue nécessairement de la base, mais a été apportée à travers une ONG basée à Montréal qui s'appelle Alternative, et qui sont, eux, sont allés chercher du cash, sont allés chercher une subvention considérable pour payer des gens pour mettre sur pied la plateforme du Centre des médias alternatifs. Donc, ça s'inscrivait déjà un peu en faux avec la philosophie autonomiste du réseau Indymédia, tel qu'il avait été conçu aux États-Unis, notamment par plein d'activistes américains, mais en vue du sommet de l'OMC à Seattle en 1999. Et je pense quand même, malgré ces différences et ces différences-là, le Centre des médias alternatifs a réussi à faire converger beaucoup de médias activistes, de journalistes indépendants à Québec et a été, je pense, très utile dans la diffusion d'informations, donc autour du sommet des Amériques. Donc ça, c'était, si on veut, la première phase de l'histoire du CEMAC, mais le CEMAC a perduré au-delà du sommet des Amériques. Et à ce moment-là, on peut dire que Alternative, qui était présente dans la première année, s'est un peu détaché, commencé à s'en coller un peu dans le fond de ce projet-là. Il n'y avait plus d'argent pour ça, puis ça ne devenait plus une priorité. Et puis ça a coïncidé aussi avec l'arrivée de certains militants anti-autoritaires, ou en tout cas avec la reprise du projet par des militants anti-autoritaires. En tout cas, ben, faut dire que dans cette année-là, de 2001, 2002, 2003, il y a eu beaucoup de discussions, il y avait un collectif de travail vraiment un collectif important autour du Centre des médias alternatifs. Il y avait beaucoup de vie associative, il y avait beaucoup d'activités, de réflexions sur quelle direction donner au projet. Une des choses qui est arrivée, c'est justement la distanciation avec l'ONG, mais en ce moment-là aussi, il y avait une discussion à savoir est-ce que le CEMAC devait être un projet totalement ouvert ou est-ce que ça devait être un projet politique, c'est-à-dire politiquement orienté, proche du mouvement anti-mondialisation, proche des mouvements anti-autoritaires, donc une plateforme qui est au service du mouvement anti-autoritaire, plutôt qu'une genre d'espèce. Il y avait aussi cette autre vision que le CEMAC devait être un genre de média alternatif, mais pas politiquement orienté. Au fil de ces discussions-là, je pense que c'est juste de dire qu'à l'issue de ces discussions-là, le CEMAC s'est défini lui-même comme un média militant au service du mouvement anticapitaliste et notamment du mouvement anti-autoritaire. Donc ça, là, on serait rendu à peu près à 2003. L'autre aspect important, c'est que la plateforme a initialement été créée dans un code propriétaire, ce qui est une autre chose qui s'inscrivait en faux avec la philosophie Indymédia. Donc, en 2000-2001, la plateforme a été créée avec un code propriétaire, ce qui est un peu absurde quand on le pense. En 2002, la plateforme...
Qu'est-ce que c'est un code propriétaire?
C'est le contraire d'un code source ouvert. C'est-à-dire que d'autres seraient peut-être en mieux en position que moi de l'expliquer, mais c'est-à-dire que le code source ouvert, c'est un code qui est développé de façon collective, qui peut être réapproprié. Le code est ouvert, donc les gens peuvent se l'approprier, le changer, le modifier, le remettre au service de la communauté, etc. Tandis que là, c'était créé avec un code source qui avait un cadenas dessus, donc dont on pouvait pas, que la collectivité ne pouvait pas s'approprier pour le modifier. Donc, c'est comme je dis, c'est au sein de la philosophie initiale d'Indymédia, il y avait cette dynamique d'ouverture de code source libre, de code source ouvert. Puis, étant donné qu'au Québec, c'est vraiment, avec ce que j'expliquais plus tôt, que c'était une dynamique d'organisation non gouvernementale qui a fait naître le projet avec leur cash, au lieu de se servir du cash de façon intelligente et ou slash militante, ils ont mis du cash pour faire développer une plateforme, pour payer du monde. Ce genre de dynamique d'ONG plutôt qu'une dynamique de base à laquelle on est habitué ou à laquelle on adhère. Donc ça, c'est la deuxième chose. En 2002, si je ne m'abuse, on a transféré la plateforme sur une plateforme de code source ouverte qui est Drupal, qui est un système de gestion de contenu ouvert, qui était en émergence à ce moment-là. En 2002, c'était les premiers balbutiements de Drupal. Maintenant, c'est rendu une espèce de multinationale coopérative. Donc ça, c'était une chose, mais ça, là, parce que justement, c'était les premiers balbutiements de Drupal, il a fallu beaucoup adapter, parce que la plateforme du CEMAC, c'est une plateforme de publication libre, mais on avait aussi une dimension de modération. Donc, il fallait pouvoir être en mesure de modérer le contenu pour empêcher la publication de matériel sexiste, raciste, oppressif, de toutes sortes. Donc, il y a eu des tweaks à apporter à la plateforme de Drupal. Et ça, ça a généré des problèmes plus tard. Je vais en revenir là-dessus. Aussi, en 2003, il y a eu une autre dynamique qui était celle de... qui était peut-être des relents de cette dynamique d'ONG, qui était d'essayer d'aller chercher de l'argent auprès des organismes charitables, d'aller chercher du cash pour embaucher quelqu'un. Et effectivement, éventuellement, on a eu du cash et on a embauché quelqu'un. Sauf que depuis, je dirais, en 2001 et 2003-2004, il y avait beaucoup d'activités autour du collectif. Il y avait plusieurs groupes de travail, on faisait des shows bénéfices. Il y avait quand même beaucoup de vie associative, beaucoup d'activités autour du collectif. Et du moment que il y a une personne qui a été embauchée pour être un peu la personne à tout faire, ça a diminué considérablement le niveau d'activité, et notamment aussi au niveau de la gestion technique de la plateforme. Donc ça, c'est une autre dimension qui a collaboré à ce que plus tard l'activité du CEMAC a chuté, étant en chute libre de 2004-2005 jusqu'à aujourd'hui. Et je peux dans le fond couper short là-dessus, mais la raison pour laquelle je dirais le CEMAC est un peu tombé en désuétude, c'est en grande partie à cause que la plateforme elle-même, la plateforme Drupal, comme elle a été beaucoup tweakée, il y a eu beaucoup de changements apportés au code, éventuellement, c'est devenu impossible de faire presser, de mettre à jour la plateforme, parce que Drupal lui-même évoluait, la plateforme technique évoluait, mais le CEMAC était tellement tweaké qu'il n'arrivait pas à se mettre à jour, et puis c'est là qu'on est. Donc, je dirais que pendant une bonne partie des années 2000, le CEMAC a été un gros morceau du milieu anti-autoritaire à Montréal, une référence, puis ça l'est encore pour un noyau dur militant à Montréal, sauf que l'émergence de plein des blogs, l'émergence des autres technologies d'information, comme on en a parlé, puis comme on va continuer d'en parler, en fait que le CEMAC, parce qu'il n'a pas été en mesure de tenir la route, est tombé un petit peu en désuétude. Donc là, on en est à ce constat-là, en fait, en 2012, que ce site-là, qui a été super important pour le mouvement, est un petit peu relégué en veilleuse, parce qu'il y a justement la Mediacoop, il y a d'autres modèles qui ont émergé. Puis aussi, je dirais, aussi une fragmentation, une autonomisation, parce qu'il y a plusieurs blogs, il y a plusieurs sources d'informations. Donc, une des pistes de solutions potentielles pour l'avenir du CEMAC, c'est déjà de refaire un collectif, je pense que ce serait la base, ensuite de refaire une nouvelle plateforme, et puis de tenir compte dans la création, la conception, la mise en œuvre de la nouvelle plateforme, de cette nouvelle réalité-là. De l'autonomisation, la multiplication des sources, puis de prendre en compte aussi de tous les outils qui sont à notre disposition. Donc, un appel que je lancerais, c'est que s'il y a des gens qui sont intéressés à reformer un collectif IndyMedia à Montréal, qui ont des skills, toutes sortes de skills, de compétences, de capacités, bien, ça serait le fun. Il y a plein de monde qui sont dedans, mais on est rendu là, dans le fond. Donc, s'il y a des gens qui sont intéressés, on planifiait déjà cet été de faire une assemblée avec les personnes intéressées pour repartir le site.
Ah, Gretchen, tu vas pouvoir nous présenter la perspective à travers ses qualités et différentes autres expériences.
Yeah, I'm actually going to start with the Indie Media experience in Seattle, because that was the first time that I was involved in anti-hierarchical media organizing, more from not just someone who used media to support communities, but also using media as your activism. Basically, whenever I first got involved with Indie Media, we were at an action camp for the Ruckus Society, which basically trains people in using activist skills, whether it's banner dropping or climbing up, you know, trees or towers, or even learning how to play music off of drums or whatever, just basically giving activists all sorts of skills, legal skills development. An action camp had happened outside of Seattle, I want to say late July, August. The actual WTO wasn't meeting until the end of November. So pretty well in advance, people got together to do this camp and exchange skills. And at one point during the camp, we randomly organized for all the independent media who had come to that space, all the various independent filmmakers, photographers. Myself, I was working for a street newspaper, so a newspaper produced by and for homeless people. And so I was working for them, as a volunteer. Being a street newspaper, didn't have a lot of money. And so we all got together and we had a planning meeting just to talk about, well, what are we going to do when the WTO comes to town as people who create media? What kind of support work are we going to do, and how are we going to organize ourselves? And so that was in that small space, sort of an early seed of Indie Media. And some of the people who were in that meeting had been at other events where basically the same types of people, media activists from, you know, in Chicago, had gotten together and said, oh, we should have a media center around the Democratic National Convention coming to town. And then they tried to organize something and it just didn't happen. So some of those people were bringing their skills of having tried to do stuff like this before. Some of these people were just really livid at the fact that indie media never gets accreditation to go into these spaces. So we're like, we're going to need a space to work, because there is a space provided to all journalists whenever these big conferences happen. But it, essentially, anyone who's not affiliated with the Call Save the Press, and even if you are affiliated with an official press whatever institution, you might not get in, because they're really selective about who gets in. So we basically wanted to create a space where people could not only have access to the tools to produce media, but we really emphasized that we wanted this to be media produced by activists. So we wanted to not only organize ourselves in an anti-hierarchical way, meaning people come in with all different sorts of experiences, knowledge, technology, or no technology, meaning they have their own equipment or they don't and they need to borrow something. So open a space, which we were very lucky to have a space provided to us like a month before the WTO came to town. So there had to be, it had to be built up. It was like a pretty raw space, like even drywall put on the wall. So it had to be built up, and skills had to be put together, and teams had to be put together to cover what was happening in the streets. And so I was one of the people responsible for coordinating the radio team. And that literally meant using the internet to contact different radio producers who were coming to town, getting people to have a sense of, okay, this is what we're going to cover, this is what so-and-so is doing, and then also getting together with people and planning to do a live web stream, which, again, was sort of one of the first times that that had been tried at a demonstration. Like, prior to the WTO meeting in Seattle in late 1999, the web wasn't really a space that a lot of activists were using to diffuse media. This was before the blogosphere, right? Like, 1998 were the first weblogs or blogs that were sort of started up. Before that, the only kind of internet space that people had access to, unless you were happened to be a tech and know about open source, were your Netscape or your Yahoo account often had like a web HTML package attached to it. And if you knew how to use their pre-formed system or whatever, maybe you could get your own website up. But at that point, there wasn't really a space where you could just go and put information like there is today or like there was years after indie media. So we wanted to create not only this anti-hierarchical knowledge exchange, technology exchange environment, but we also wanted to create an open, not just like using open source technology, but also make an open platform for people to publish. So this is where the notion of open publishing came from, and it's links, there's links between open publishing and the ideas around that, like having an editorial policy that really represents what's happening on the streets and the point of view from activists, as opposed to the kind of editorial policies that you see in newsrooms, which basically fulfill the agendas of the state or governments or whatever corporations are running them. So basically, not only having that anti-hierarchical environment, but having that also influence the kind of content that gets out there, so that there's an open publishing mandate for the newswire. And that those set up all kinds of challenges and dynamics within indie media, because there's the goals, what you try to do, and how you have to modify things along the way to fix all the little problems, right? Like, indie media had great goals and great vision, but there were problems with technology, because technology creates certain dynamics, right? Technology is one of those things that can create privilege. So you have people at, you know, within the indie media, and I'm going to pick on the techs for a while, within the tech collective, who really understand this notion of open source and really understand how the website works, but then they also get 50 to 100 emails a day saying, oh, this link is broken, or I need password because I want to fix this, and then there's a bottleneck of people accessing the space as much as other people are accessing the space, because they don't have the password, or they don't understand the technology. So the kind of, you know, results from the sort of privilege that people get when they either understand technology or they just have access to it more than others. There were other things that we had sort of achieved in that first round experience of indie media in Seattle, one of which was not only the unfiltered newswire, but the live unfiltered web stream that we were providing. Again, with the web, the platforms that were available at that time, streaming was becoming new, like the idea of broadcasting audio over the internet. Like, now we have the idea of broadcasting video over the internet. But back then, that wasn't really an option, even for like the open source activist community, the notion of live video streaming. But what was an option and what was free through various like platforms that existed then. One was like log365.com, which I don't think even exists anymore, but back then it was like one of the free options where you could go and set up a live audio stream and have a certain number of free listeners. You know, you fought 50 to 100. So what we were doing in Seattle was setting up a live stream, but then inviting pirate radio stations across the country to carry that content. And we had people from really far away doing that kind of broadcasting for us. We had people listening to the stream over the internet all around. And we had people broadcasting that stream right over the island of Seattle all around. Anyway, so aside from the live direct stream, one of the things that we were able to do for the first time was carry live sound from the street. So not just having people in studio talking about what's happening, but we had cell phones out in the streets carrying report backs from legal teams. You know, there was a jail support the day after November 30th and the WTO was shut down. We had jail support happening because there were massive arrests, like 600 people arrested and detained over buses overnight, like really shitty conditions, and a lot of like young people, so first-time arrestees. And it was a pretty shit situation in the jails and with the cops. There was obviously a lot of gas, a lot of brutality that people had experienced. People were pretty freaked out. There was martial law declared downtown Seattle. So, you know, basically people were like in a state of, you know, shock in the streets. And we wanted to carry a lot of that live because we wanted to draw attention to the cause and get people to come. And there were many people coming from around. There were people driving from as far away as Texas just to show up in Seattle like next day overnight because they were so upset about what had happened in the streets on the 30th of November. And so we were outside of the jails with cell phones, and that was the first time I had personally experienced mic check. You know, this notion of like talking without a megaphone and having the crowd repeat it back to you, which has become kind of an emblem of the Occupy movement. But in Seattle, people didn't call it mic check. People just said, okay, we need everybody to listen right now, and this is the way we're going to do it. And we were able to use the cell phone to carry that conversation. So we had the cell phone pointed up to the crowd, and people would be repeating stuff back. And we were able to carry that and broadcast it, not over, only on the internet, but on all the pirate radio stations that were carrying it too. So people had that live, direct connection to the streets. And you also heard us on the cell phone being like, can you hear that? Is that working? Because we didn't know, right? Like, but then obviously after the other INC convergences, we knew. So what's the benefit of this in terms of the challenge to corporate media, the public media, or even the state? One of the things that was great is that we really took them by surprise. The fact that, you know, the cops were lying on camera to the mainstream media saying, we're not using chemical weapons, we're not using rubber bullets. And then Indie Media publishes a video saying, you're shooting rubber bullets, here they are, and here's the footage of it. You know, so we were able to be the counterpoint right away. And that's why there was a lot of love from the movement, because people started wearing signs and carrying placards that said Indie Media, tune in at Indie Media, which is great, because otherwise it was just up to us to try to defuse that website, defuse that location. So obviously, Indie Media, because it had this bias towards the activists, we were able to expose the bias of the state-controlled media and the corporate-run media. You know, whenever your bias is so open and so overt, you only expose the bias of the media. And I think it's great that that kind of happens again and again. On this issue of property rights and copyright and the influence of that on our work as media activists, I just wanted to bring up a quick point that we should also not only think about that the proprietary information and like codes and the limitations that get created, the kind of privileges that I was mentioning before when it comes to like being able to access technology or access a code or be able to develop a code. You know, there's also this issue of infrastructure, the kind of wires that are being used. Who owns what platform? You know, we have to think of copyright issues and corporate control when it also comes to platforms. So yes, we have Twitter, yes, we have Facebook, but who owns those platforms? And what is that information being used for? And how is it going to be used against you? You know, like, Facebook is open. Like, the cops can go and look at that shit. And Facebook shares stuff with the cops, you know, and so does Google and certain, you know, like, there's no safety in those platforms. And then the other complication with that is that it can be taken away from you at any moment, you know. Like, we see around the world governments who want to repress the internet technologies do so. They can slow it down, they can shut it off. It happened in Egypt, right? Like, internet technology was shut off. It happens all the time in Iran. It gets slowed down. I mean, people notice the same thing here, but it needs to be further documented. I wanted to say another issue about ITCs and whether they help or hurt the movement. I think they help a lot if we use them to our benefit, but we have to be very smart and very strategic about using them, and we always have to think of the implications. And I think they can obviously hurt, too, because, again, with more cell phones and more video, there's more people out there capturing things that are potentially illegal that can get people criminalized. But the value of having media activists organize with a mandate and a goal is that you're organizing yourself not to criminalize people, right? Like, whenever we were going out in the streets as indie media, we weren't there to, like, put those people smashing things in jail. We were there to help those people smashing things, explain why they're smashing things, and get their message out, whether you agree with it or not. And these were the debates we had within indie medias. Are you really going to go out there and be the cops? You know, like, the media, the mainstream media is out there for that. The police are out there for that. Who is helping these people explain what they're doing? You know, they have just as much right to this space and to make a political point of view in the means, I mean, again, diversity of tactics, right? Like, not only as media activists did we have a diversity of tactics, but we wanted to embrace the diversity of tactics of others. So these were all sorts of debates that we had. I just wanted to put those points out there, and